This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jimmy hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
I'm gonna find that girl. I'm gonna find that girl. I'm gonna find that girl. I'm gonna find that girl.
She was last seen walking around Sunset. Said that she was trying to get home.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, broadcasting to all of you throughout this great world of ours, all the ships at sea, all over the United States and elsewhere, and of course all of my beloved fans here, Texas and parts therein. Coming to you in high-definition audio, or something quite like it, from the ringing, cozy confines of Trinidad World Recording Studios, my studio here in Fort Worth. How you doing this week, everybody? Phil Pritchett here, as always. Thrilled to be with you. Delighted. How's everybody doing out there? Christmas is here. The season is upon us. Oh, my. Love it. I've always just been such a Christmas buff, man. I was one of those nerdy kids. I'd want to put like Christmas lights in my own room, around my window. If Mom had an extra strand of lights or something, I always like to decorate it a little bit. Hardcore traditionalist when it comes to Christmas, man. No opening presents early. No walking into the living room on Christmas morning without the other brothers and sisters. Got to close your eyes past a certain point on the floor. All kinds of stuff like that. No breaking the rules. And it's no different in my own home these days with my own children. Let me tell you what. There's rules to be adhered to. The Christmas season. Oh, man. A lot of going to church. A lot of seeing family. Great stuff. Sports, football, music. Nothing bad about this time of year for me, man. Food, glorious food. Everywhere. Loving it. How you doing, everybody? Phil here. Well, man, we have a great show for you here. Man, how you like our old friend Chance Ryan Brentham dropping by last week? Talking about Clint Rippey, the great drummer. Well, guess what? Guess what? As promised, he will be here in our second segment to continue further discussions on his film about the enigmatic drummer Clint Rippey. Check out the trailers at whoisclintrippey.com, and you'll see your old friend Phil in some of those clips. Jamming with Clint, as my band and I have done. He's also playing with Jack Ingram and Pat Green and other guys, you know. Fun stuff. Got a lot of exciting things happening there with the film. So check that out, man. Stay tuned in our second segment. And then the vault. Oh, man, we don't even know what we're going to do yet. We don't even know what we're going to do. Playing it on the fly, everybody. We're just going to see. I'm going to wander over to the vault there and put my hands on something. We'll pull something out and talk about it here. Amongst friends, as friends that we are. Well, man, I ran into an issue the other day. Help me with it. Can you help me with this? And thanks again for all your emails. Next week, we're going to be answering some viewer email in this first segment. It's been stacking up. Got piles, man. I got hard drives filled with your emails, beckoning for some sort of response. I hope I email you back and just say, hey, thanks for emailing in. At least do that. I'm going to try to get some of them on the air here. Phil@PhilPritchett.com. Send me your comments, your thoughts, your complaints. Anything is welcome. Send it on. Well, riddle me this. We go to the Hillsboro. I mentioned this on stage a couple weeks ago. A conundrum here for the full band. You see, Blue, our bass player, J.W. Blue Marshall, lives in my old hometown, Dallas, Texas. And then Stu and I live in Fort Worth, So if we're heading south, we're heading down south the other night to play at Sam's Burger Joint. Thanks for coming out, everybody. Fun time. So we're heading down south there, the 235s, east and west. We rendezvous in Hillsboro, Texas, at our beloved Starbucks down there. You can look over there and see J-Dub's car abandoned for a few days. On a lot of Fridays, feel free to rummage about through his gym clothes and old fast food wrappings. You know, I've been talking to J-Dub about coming on the show. I think he's going to be coming in here the next couple weeks. So look forward to that. The full band's own J.W. Marshall here on the podcast in the coming weeks. So we get to the Starbucks. Stuart Wiley, as he is wont to do, goes into the Starbucks to purchase a large, large container of scalding hot coffee. I think, man, that sounds good. It's kind of a cold day, so I go in there as well. It's kind of crowded. You know, Starbucks, the Christmas season, you got the Christmas blend coffee that I love. Oh, that's the best blend. I wait all year for it, the Christmas blend. If you want to send Phil a Christmas present, send the Christmas blend from Starbucks. So, Stu gets some coffee. It's kind of crowded, so I don't know if we're going to sit outside. It's kind of a brisk day, but it felt kind of good. I look over there, Stu's sitting down. So I go to sit down by Stu. He's like, have a seat, man. So I go over there, and I pull up short. He's sitting at the table with the little, handicap logo on it. You know, the table that's attached to the wall near the door, accessible to someone perhaps in a wheelchair or something could sit there. And Stu's just sitting there, oblivious. I didn't know it was out of line. I said, dude, I can't sit there. He's like, what are you talking about, man? There's a table sitting here enjoying my coffee. I'm like, you're sitting at the handicap table. You can't sit there. Can you? Stu's like, Stu just kind of looks over his shoulder casually and goes, I don't see anybody handicapped in here, man. I'm sitting here enjoying my coffee. You do whatever you want. I go, well, dude, isn't that kind of like parking in the parking place? I mean, you got a bunch of handicapped spots at a restaurant or something. I go, you can't just pull into one of them and go, they can use one of the other ones. Or you know what? If some handicapped guy shows up, you know what? Okay, I'll move my car. I'm kind of like, dude, this is not how it works. These are sacred spots, not to be trespassed around by able-bodied citizens like yourself. Stu. So I don't know. I don't want to put him down or anything. I just say, man, look, I'm a little uncomfortable with this. But he sits there enjoying his coffee. So I go over there and I just cram into a little chair in the corner. Well, eventually Stu kind of, he looks around and he's just stretched out at this big table, you know, a little higher than normal, nice and wide. But he finally kind of hangs his head in shame, nods his head knowingly, grabs his coffee and he comes and joins me at a small wobbly table by the door. So I don't know. The discussion continued. Blue didn't know where to come down on this deal. Blue was very puzzled by it. You know, it's like an issue you'd seen like Seinfeld. You know, it's kind of a Seinfeld problem, an issue that George Costanza and Jerry would just go round and round on. Is that a written rule? The handicapped table? Don't sit at the handicapped table if there's no other tables available. Phil at philpritchard.com. Let me know your thoughts, especially if you're a handicapped person out there. Are you insulted? You know, I kind of compared it to if there's a handicapped stall in the bathroom, wider, more accommodating. Can you go in there and use it if there's no handicapped guy? We all do that if the line's long, of course. But I tell you what, man, you don't want to come out of that stall and see some guy who's waiting for it in a wheelchair, you know? That's no good. So I try to avoid any sort of uneasy confrontation like that. So I digress. I'm out on the handicap. I don't tread upon it. Do not tread upon it. But am I out of line here? Am I taking too seriously? Let me know. Phil at philpritchard.com. Oh, man, the travails of the full band on the road. The travails, the things we think about and discuss in the van. That's what this show's all about, no? Well, let me tell you what, man. I read a great blog the other day. Our old friend Bob Lefsetz. Points me in the directions of Wayne's World. Written by Wayne Russo. It's at WayneRusso.com, R-O-S-S-O, Rosso Russo. Anyway, it's a commentary. He's kind of a music insider kind of guy commentating on kind of the business aspect of the music industry. Always looking for stuff like this. Had some fascinating numbers on there I was going to share with some of you guys. You know our old friend Rick Rubin, the great producer, right? Man, he produced, everybody. all those Johnny Cash comeback albums, you know, that was all Rick Rubin, produced Wildflowers, Tom Petty. Oh, geez, tons of others, man. I'm drawing a blank here. Of course, he's done Metallica, Beastie Boys. Early Beastie Boys is all Rick Rubin. A great producer, Red Hot Chili Peppers. You know, he's done all these guys. Well, man, a few years ago, Columbia Records makes him their, guys, their president or their West Coast guy. Everyone knows the record business is struggling. They're not selling any records. So Columbia Records, Sony, also under the Sony umbrella, I believe, throws a Hail Mary. They go, dude, we got to get somebody in here with some cred. Somebody's going to shake it up. You know, not some suit, man, not some stiff guy. We need an artist, you know, to run this label. So they get Rick Rubin. Well, anybody knows anything about Rick Rubin, he is a producer. He's an eccentric man and an artist of the highest. Every picture you see him, he's like levitating. You know, he's meditating somewhere. He's got this long beard. He sleeps all day. He's up all night. Rick Rubin, man, come on. You think of a producer, man. He's wearing sunglasses inside. A man after my own heart. So Rubin comes in to run the label. Anyway, this article this guy wrote is just fascinating. It's just how the whole thing has kind of blown up in Columbia's face. You know, Rick just hates going to meetings. He hates getting on airplanes and flying to New York. He won't fly. He won't meet with anybody. He never goes to the office. Just all this bizarre stuff. And on and on and on it went. But they had a list of some of the records that he has produced since coming aboard at Sony and Columbia. If you're like me, man, I always want to know how many something sells. You know, you see some new album by so-and-so. You're like, they talk about how the sales aren't any good. I'm like, does that mean they sold, you know, a couple million? Is that suck? Or did they sell 40,000? I have no idea. Well, here's a few notes, man. Total scan totals and sound scan. I had some numbers here from some of these things that Rubin was involved with. I guess put them out, produced. Some of them I'm not too familiar with, but some of them I am. Gosh, what grabbed my attention? 2008, Weezer. Their album, Weezer. Blake Walker out there, he's probably responsible for several of these titles. But it sold 465,000 copies. I thought that was pretty good. Gosh, but what else, man? There's a ton on here of acts I don't really know. That sold like 19,000, 3,000, 13,000. Neil Diamond did that album in 2008. Home Before Dark, 432,000. That's not even gold. That's hard to believe. Metallica, Death Magnetic. That was 1,910,000. Boy, they got some fans, dude. Metallica. People still go out and buy that stuff. Something a little closer to home. Man, Pete Yorn, man. I like Pete Yorn. He's cool, right? Cool songwriter. 56,000 copies since his record came out in 2009. Back and forth. Golly, that's not a lot, man. Brandi Carlile, man. I hear a lot about Brandi Carlile. You know that song? This is called Give Up the Ghost. Brandi Carlile, 2009. I think T-Bone Burnett produced that record. If I'm not mistaken, perhaps that's another one. But she sold 119,000. That doesn't sound like a lot to me, man. Kid Rock, 2010. Born Free, man. Album. Did Rubin produce that? I'm not sure. But he had something to do with it. 292,000. Josh Groban, 290,000. Man, those just aren't a lot of copies, man. Jacob Dylan. Where was he on here? Oh, Seeing Things. That was a good record. 126,000 copies. Avett Brothers. That's a good album. I and Loving You. 252,000. Not a lot, but they got to be pleased with that, though. That's kind of that Americana alternative stuff. So anyway, some numbers there, man. Pretty interesting. Pretty low. Goodness gracious. Oh, man. You know, Kurt South, our old friend, called me the other day. He's up there in Virginia. South, how you doing? You know of whom I speak, the Dark Didactic Lord himself. Well, man, he's up there. He's in a new life up there in Virginia. He calls me the other day. We talk a lot about the value of free music on this show, yes. You know, bands ought to make some things available and all that. There's always a discussion for, you know, what to charge for music. Well, Kurt calls me the other day. He goes, dude, I've had an epiphany. I've been away from music for a little bit. And, man, I have an epiphany. Man, you've got to pay for music, which I agreed with him. I just said, man, but what do you charge, man? And he said, well, that remains to be seen. He goes, but, you know, we kind of got sucked into the, hey, man, just give all your stuff away for free. It's music, man. All right, all right. Kurt goes, man, I just think that's just, that's bad thinking, dude. It's really, really no good. And his point was, I thought he had a great point, because he goes, man, remember back in the late 90s, right before Napster, we were all paying $15, $20 for a CD. God, man, they, bands like Counting Crows were back then, you know, Hootie and Alanis Morissette, Sheryl Crow. Some of those albums just sold tens of millions, man, people paying $15, $20 for them. But, man, you did not hear a voice one. Not a voice one, at least in my world, of anyone going, man, these CDs are so expensive, man. I just can't believe I got to pay all this money for them. God, what am I going to do? People were still buying them, man, in big heaping piles. Pricing was not the problem. It was not the issue. But then when Napster came out in 2000, people saw they could just steal it, and so they started doing it. And Kurt argues that, really, it's kind of a hindsight deal, because people are like, man, stealing's wrong and stuff like that. And people want to go, well, man, they were just ripping us off the whole time, man. For years, the record industry was just ripping us off, man, making us charge, you know, charging us $15, $20. You know what? And a lot of the CDs only had one good song on it. Kurt goes, man, I think that's a lot of revisionist history. If you're really honest with yourself, were you just pissed and objected, just horrified by what you had to pay for some album at Waterloo Records in Austin? No, man, you saved up your money, went there and like, oh, sweet, the new old 97s or what? You'd buy it, you know, you'd be thrilled to have it. So his point was just, Kurt was just making the point that, man, just don't be too snowed by people saying music was too expensive anyway. He said, man, sales would tell you the exact opposite in the late 90s, right before Napster. And just because you can steal something doesn't mean that you should. Doesn't mean that it's right. And, he, and you know, Kurt, man, the ever Confederate up there, conservative guy, he just goes, man, it's just, of course, he hates our guy, Bob Lefsetz, we were talking about. And, man, he just goes, you know, he said, Lefsetz, he's always just like, man, what's Metallica so mad about? They're rich anyway. He goes, okay, so they're rich anyway. That's okay for you to just steal something that you should have to pay for? You should, you know, just be able to steal it because the guy's already rich? You know, he's like, man, can I just go into the Apple store and help myself to an iPod just because, Steve Jobs ain't going to miss this one. He's rich already. He deserves, you know, I deserve to have it, you know, because I can't afford it or it's expensive or whatever it is. And anyway, Kurt South opining there. Of course, I make a lot of stuff available for free, but I do charge $4 for it. I consider the MP3s less, I don't know, less than some big album I make with a lot of artwork and stuff like that. Interesting food for thought, man. Interesting food for thought. I thought that was a great point, though, about the late 90s. You really didn't, if you're really honest with yourself. You or anyone else was not really complaining. In fact, we were just going to the CD store. I was. And just buying whatever I wanted all the time. And that was it. All that has changed. Where is it going? We don't know. Well, rapping at my chamber door, it is our old friend Chance Ryan Brentham. Going to come in here and talk about his new film, Clint Rippey. Who is Clint Rippey? Enigmatic drummer. I'm going to talk more about that with Chance in our next segment. Stay tuned.
Some matters require high speed, but the important things you got to take slow. Yeah, I'll try to be what you see in me more than I just choose to show. I'm going to find that girl. I'm going to find that.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the Pizzu Podcast, enlightening your musical life, broadcasting to you throughout the world, throughout the globe, at pizzupodcast.com, where you can just go download any episode in the history of the podcast and listen to it right there on the spot. Where else in broadcasting can you do that? Try going back and listening to yesterday's radio program. It doesn't exist. But we make these podcasts, folks, like bands make records. They are just living documents to be interpreted years from now. Well, no doubt one of the most talked about shows we've had in a long time in the history of this great show. Thanks to all the fans for listening out there. No doubt has been the show with Chance Ryan Brentham months back talking about our friend Clint Rippey, the great enigmatic drummer who has played shows with me, Gosh, people all over the world, but notably for you fans out there here in Texas primarily, Jack Ingram, Pat Green, you've seen him walk on stage with his long beard and hair and tight shorts sometimes, smoking the cigar. Famous for his groundbreaking album Symbolic, which is nothing but him playing cymbals, revered by artists throughout the world. Our friend Chance Ryan Brentham is here, as he was last week, to shed some light on the documentary he has been making now, tirelessly, for over, how long has it been now? A couple years?
It's going on its fifth year.
Fifth year? God, this is just like a body of work, a life's work here, the story of Clint Rippey. Yes. Well, thanks for coming back this week, Chance, the podcast. I always get a lot of emails when you're on. Intrigued with Clint and everything. Of course, you can go see whoisclintrippey.com. There's beautiful high-definition Vimeo trailers with the film. Yours truly, Phil, popping up in there a few times. And a recent trailer with all kinds of interesting stuff about Symbolic. Got Jack Ingram in there, Pat Green talking about Clint. Mm. So check that out. So, man, we were getting into a little bit last week about what you've been doing lately on the film. It seems like so many people are willing to jump on board. You know, people who know Clint and are in the industry who say, man, we'll give you microphones or what you can record here. Man, we'll interview for it. It goes and it goes and it goes. Is there and this is more of a question for you rather than a topic about Clint. What do you see as kind of the end game for the film? What's your vision for the film coming together? I know you can't predict what Clint's going to do and all that. You got to wait. Do you aspire to get it into festivals or just to release it locally kind of deal? Is there sort of a plan for the documentary?
Absolutely. I think the key word here is documentary.
Right.
Most documentaries have, some have thousands of hours of footage.
Right, right.
And, we're pushing that right now.
Yeah.
5 years of filming it. The thing with Clint is it's not a continuous everyday event.
Yeah. It's hard to game plan for a lot of the stuff you're doing.
Like Clint does with music, he does with us.
Yeah.
Sometimes we can't find him. Sometimes he's supposed to be at a gig and we show up and he's not there. And
right.
So there's, five guys,
challenges there.
Two guys, however big our crew is that day, mm-hmm. waiting for an artist and that's not there. And
right.
So, and then sometimes you get the pearl. You get him and it's beautiful.
Right.
What you get.
And what are some of those times do you feel like? Just sort of off that, what do you think that I know it's tough in editing to think we're using this, we're not using it. Are there a couple little moments, scenes, performances where you just go, man, no question that's going to be in there?
Sure.
What stands out? What stands out in your mind, though, with maybe the top, maybe a couple that would be in the top 5 or 10?
There's a wealth of them. We have a lot of beautiful archival footage. When he did this stuff in New York.
Which was what? Explain that to our listening public out here.
Right. In the late 90s, right about the time that he did Symbolic, he did a performance art show in New York.
Now, you talk a lot about his performance art. I'm not as familiar. I'm more of his
right. –
I'm not as familiar with his performance art stuff.
Well, it was an underground
– What are we seeing there? I haven't seen his performance art stuff.
Well, basically, and nobody has unless you've seen the show. It was a time that Skins, his drum tech, had,
right.
Clint basically writes notes to Skins and leaves them in random areas. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything about the guy is eccentric.
Right.
And Skins will get these notes and it'll say, performance art show this Friday.
Right.
P.S.
Pick up milk at the store.
Exactly. Well, I mean,
it's a sticky note on the fridge.
Skins has shown us some, and sometimes it is that random.
Yeah, right.
In fact, he even talks about once the performance art show started, Clint would leave notes saying, there's one piece that he would say, pick up tuna and fish market.
Well, what would I see? I mean, give me a real life example. If I bought a ticket or I said, hey, the great Clint Rippey's going to be at this club performance art show, I don't know what to expect.
Right. Well, what has happened? Let me tell you what happened with, first of all, getting the show.
Okay.
Skins started calling the people that he knew. Alan Pepper, who owned the famous Bottom Line in New York, was one of their good friends, and or one of Skin's good friends, and he loved Clint. It was a huge fan. And he said, you know, this is what we want to do. And Alan had said, you know, well, we can give you the Bottom Line. And he said, no, Clint wants it to be a very special audience, a small audience. And he said, well, let us figure something out. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the week, they had knocked out some rooms in the upstairs of the Bottom Line and created a small performance space that held no more than 80
people. Just like
people.
A dressing room kind of thing up there? Or,
It was. I mean, they...
So he's not he's playing at the club, but he's not going to play in the actual club.
Right.
He's going to play upstairs in a
And it, the thing about it, it wasn't advertised.
You're like me saying I'm playing the Granada Theater, but I'm playing in the lobby.
Right.
You're just like, well, why aren't you playing in the venue? Just, well, we're playing in the lobby tonight.
And Clint is like that. I mean,
yeah,
he's
right.
got some random requirements.
A different take, right.
And
but what does he do? Does he come out and eat a jar of peanut butter? Or what does he do?
That's the beautiful thing, because it wasn't at the time – well, we didn't know this until we talked to Alan Pepper. But he actually documented it. And with Clint's permission –
and
he has the stuff in the vault. So the stories would be, you know, Clint didn't show up tonight.
Okay.
And it was kind of an industry secret. Everybody knew that when you were in New York, Clint was doing a performance art show. Or you would hear randomly, hey, tonight Clint's doing a performance art show.
Right.
It ran for 2 years on
show.
And off.
Okay.
Yeah. And you would show up. Some of the stories we have is people showing up and there being this array of instruments.
Okay.
And Clint's showing up 45 minutes late. The audience is getting restless.
Okay.
Clint walks out, picks up a brick, which is in this array of instruments, and plays two notes on it and walks off the stage.
Kind of a brick, like plucks a guitar,
like,
kind of bum, bum, and then walks away.
Yeah.
That's the show.
That's it. And
that would be one night.
That would be one night.
Okay.
And so they would be like, what? The crap. I mean, like,
No one even understood why they were there.
Right. And the next night they would come back, and if they could get tickets.
Right.
And they would walk in.
I mean, how many does that place hold, the upstairs room?
You're talking like 40, 75, 50? 80.
Okay.
I mean, illegally 80, I think.
Right.
So it's very intimate audience.
A lot of nights he wouldn't be there.
A lot of nights he wouldn't show up. A lot of nights he would play for like 4 hours.
Sounds like a Guns N' Roses gig.
Oh.
You know, I don't know if the show's going to actually happen.
Exactly.
But that's kind of part of the – I guess that's part of the art.
Well, and
is it?
Well, that's the fascinating thing. We talk to a lot of Broadway –
vacancy.
A lot of Broadway people that I talk about after the
Does
show.
Does art require attendance? Does it require presence?
And that's the perspective that you get. I mean, that's the opinion that you get when you walk off out of that room.
You walk out of there asking yourself a lot of questions about what a performance is.
And what is the root word of music?
Yeah.
Muse.
Yeah, right.
So
what does that mean?
What I get
baffled
from that.
Yeah.
A friend told me that one time. But
root word of
I think
music.
It's to amuse yourself, to think,
to muse, to ponder.
To
ponder, okay.
You know?
Okay.
And I think Clint really understands that. And he's made me ponder things.
Well, what else? Okay, when he does show up, he plays two notes with a brick one time. Is there anything? What else are some examples of what happened?
One that fascinated me is we heard the story. And it's just so random. But we heard the story that the audience was there.
Mm-hmm.
Clint showed up late that night. And by this time, you know, we're talking, I think it was about 4 months into the performance or the production. And everybody was riveted when he would walk on stage.
Sure.
They didn't know what to expect. They were just, they kind of have thrown all of their predetermined reasoning out the door, if that
right.
makes sense. And
expectations
so, yeah. out the door, and we're just ready to receive. And
this is just this is getting cerebral for me.
There is
cerebral. So what happens?
Well, let me be patient.
Are you with me, fans? What happens?
There was a pane of glass.
Okay.
About 6 feet by three.
On a stand?
On a stand.
Okay. Like
in
an
a frame.
Easel.
Yeah, and like in a frame, right.
All right.
And, you know, everybody had seen the Blue Man Group do the whole
right.
they do the thing where they smear whipped cream, I mean, shaving cream on it, and then they do this art with it. And so a lot of people were thinking, well, maybe it's going to be something like that. He's going to paint on it, or he's going to play drums on it.
We've seen this.
He walks out in a suit that actually had a head covering, a head protecting thing, and had a hammer in his hand.
Like a hazmat suit? Like a Epicurus beekeeper kind of deal? Not a suit like a Brooks Brothers suit.
No. Okay. And has a hammer in his hand, stands behind the pane for 2 minutes, mm-hmm. in silence, smashes the glass, it goes everywhere on the stage, and he walks off.
And that was it?
That was it. And the audience had waited, I think it was 45 minutes to an hour, for this guy to walk up on stage. But what do you... the fascinating thing is that the people that saw that show walk away with all kinds of ideas of what that means, the significance, what it means in their own life to shatter that glass, that wall.
Does anyone ever just go, wait a minute, this guy's just putting us all over?
Oh, yeah.
This is a joke. I mean, you know.
And that's.
I mean, does he, on nights where he doesn't show up, does he still show up and get the gate? Does he get a payment for these things? I mean, just that's part of the show. He wasn't here.
Well, that's the thing
about
it.
He still gets, you know.
He doesn't care about money.
Well, I know.
So everything, actually, the price for the ticket was like $5.
See, I wasn't aware of all this. You know, when he was doing some gigs with us, I just thought I knew he was kind of a guy that played locally with some of these other guys. I didn't know about the whole New York and his performance art background.
Right.
But that was really kind of what he... of course, it makes sense now, looking at how he plays the drums and stuff. Like, man, he has a whole background in you know, doing odd things that make people ponder and muse their own existence, you know.
He's a visual artist. I mean, he's known for his paintings. He paints drums, drum heads, drums, cymbals.
Oh, really? I don't know if I've seen...
He does his art on that. It's very underground. He designs his own drum sets, which what kit was he playing with you that night?
I don't know. I think he had.
I think it was the green.
Sparkle, yeah, the sparkle green.
Sparkle green one. He's got a whole basically warehouse. I mean, it's a small warehouse full of drums, full of random instruments. But he actually designs and does artwork on his drums.
Yeah.
And. One of the things we just found out that the Smithsonian is about to do, or they're talking, they're discussing about doing a display of his
instruments,
of his collection.
Does he have like? Yeah, I noticed he had like some. I mean, I didn't take a real close look at it, but the drums were very different looking. I couldn't tell if they were like really old or if they were new.
He has everything from
there are little etchings and drawings, and there was stuff on there,
and a lot of it's not
hieroglyphic
noticeable.
Type stuff. But
right, you
have to look pretty closely.
Yeah.
I didn't want to ask him, like, man, what is all this stuff all over your...
Sure.
But does he work on them and tool around on his drums or paint?
You know, it's funny because a lot of the artwork is on the top part.
Uh-huh.
And or the parts that you can see while you're sitting behind the drum set. And one of the things that Skin says is he gets bored sometimes back there, and he just starts drawing on his drums.
Right.
And, like, that's where it
I don't know if he was doing any drawing when he was playing with us.
Right.
Did he
show up? Was he on time that night?
Man, he was. He was on time. He might have been a little bit late, but you know, we were alerted that he'd be there, and he was.
Good.
I'd had a session with him where, that he didn't. We didn't know when he'd show up, and he was about an hour late. But so I was prepared for that with the show. But he was. That night he just kind of materialized right about the time we were gonna,
and I was
go on.
So sad. I was actually in New York doing some interviews when we got the call that you guys were gonna be playing, and so
it was
I
funny.
Sent my B crew out there,
right? And it was cool because we had it was just, I mean, it was literally just like a flatbed in a field out there in Bernie,
right?
Like it wasn't, you know, Clint's played all these different gigs in New York, you know. And this was just a, you know, kind of an outdoor gig, like we play a lot, you know, in Texas, just an outdoor kind of restaurant thing, very casual, you know. But he was on time. It was very, very normal show probably for him, but still did that. I mean, he can't, you know, like between songs, he started like the little top part on the hi-hat, the little part above the cymbal.
Uh-huh.
Does that have a name? I don't even know what it is, the stand, you know.
Right.
And we finished the song. I said, thanks very much. And I kept hearing this little rolling groove. And I look back, and he's just playing like a yeah, I guess like a solo on just this part of the stand. And it went on. I thought he was just goofing around, so I kind of waited for him to stop. And he kept, you know, it's kind of like him leading the show. I was like, no, we need to do something with this. This is what's happening next. So we started doing one of our train beat kind of songs with him going, and we did a little slower than we usually do it, but it was kind of in time with the
That's awesome.
Thing. And then he moved and he started playing the hi-hat and all different counter rhythms, and it was bizarre, man.
What?
So I started singing my song, so the crowd was into it and singing, and then you do have those guys in the crowd. There was kind of these dudes off to the side that were like, man, that drummer man was on that. They didn't really know who Clint was.
Sure.
And they were like, man, that guy was just, you know, getting a feel for the whole thing, you know. Mm. They were picking up on all the weird stuff he was doing and all the different. And I said, well, you know, he's kind of he's an artist in his own right. He's not really in our band. He's just here for the night.
Right.
But, yeah, bizarre stuff, man. But, yeah, the Beat Crew was there for that. That's what's in the trailer, I guess.
Yeah.
That show.
That's what we – and I don't know – this is the thing that astonishes me most about him, is that he can make art out of anything. And even the way he walks, even the way he talks, I realize that there's a rhythm to everything that he does. And it's not necessarily a drum rhythm, but it's kind of a rhythm of life. And I think that's what he does, and that's how he
breathes. The rhythm of life, that's right.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here, Chance.
Thanks for having me.
For sharing all your experience on the Clint Rippey Project. So fascinating. Everyone's going to be emailing me about all this. I'll try to answer your emails the best I can about Clint. Very mysterious. Thank you, Chance, for being here. Well, it's that time for me to blindfold myself, walk to the rack of vinyl records on the wall, choose one, and just see if it has any presence. Or maybe I'll do like Clint. I'll just play silence, play nothing, and we'll talk about that. We'll see you in the vault next. Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchard here on the P2 Podcast, coming to you from Trinidad World Recording Studios, my beautiful studio here in Fort Worth. All you bands out there, artist, singer, songwriter, come record here in Fort Worth, as Kelly Joe Cordova in the whole shooting match just did, as Seth Jones just did, and so many others, man. We've been working on lots of cool stuff. Brian Hunt and his band, Brian Sachs, all you guys. People all over the state, all over the country have come in here to Trinidad to record. Oh, man, you stay down there by the Lone Star Oyster Bar. Woody's down there, huh? Huh? Hanging out, kicking it at night, recording all day. Great, fun stuff. So call me, 817-733-5256. Phil, I've got a band. I've heard your podcast. What can you do, man? Here's all I've got. And we got a certain amount of time to do it. Let's do it. And we'll make something work, man. You will love it. Trinidad World Recording is what we do. Well, well, well. How do I love the Who? Let me count the ways. Oh, they're one of these bands that are so obviously awesome, you don't even want to put them in the vault. I want to turn y'all on to stuff maybe you hadn't thought about, maybe you haven't heard. But I fear maybe that some of y'all out there don't give the Who their due. Oh, you got the greatest hits. You're listening to Pinball Wizard of My Generation. Yes, 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 yes. But let me tell you what, man. There's a lot to the Who. A lot that's tough to digest, I think. They get in these weird, almost fruity sort of operatic things. You know, Tommy has some moments on there that are ponderous at best. But man, you know, it all plays out in a theatrical sense, I believe. Quadrophenia, another album of theirs, which was, you know, long and parts of it very interesting, hard to take. But man, I come back to this album. This is kind of right in the middle of all that. This is Live at Leeds, maybe the Who's definitive live album, one of the all-time definitive live albums. What's so cool about this is, to me, as always, just how much space there is in the songs. When they do something real quiet, or they pause, or between songs, there's just applause and then silence. You really sense the audience watching a band play. It's very different than today, where all anyone does on stage at Billy Bob's is go, "How y'all doing tonight? What?" Just, there's this sense that if people aren't just screaming uncontrollably the whole time, that the show's not doing very well. On all of our live albums in the past, just da 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 da, we just cue up the wow, the crowd, you know, because you don't want it to sound like nobody's clapping, right? Hey, guilty as charged. But it's funny, if you really go back and listen to Who, man, there's just, it's kind of there's people there, but you know, it's a sedate kind of deal. They're watching the show, they're enjoying a performance of a rock and roll band, you know. So, well, this is one of their big hits, man, but they kicked it at Live at Leeds. Check it out, man. Still trying to figure out this bass solo. My generation, of course. On the PG Podcast. Try to put us down by my generation. Oh, just because we're talking about my generation. It's a new awful talking about my generation. If I die before I get old, talking about my generation. It's my generation. It's my generation, baby. Why don't you all tell me about my generation? Don't try to dig. The Who. Ah, ha, ha. The mightiest rock band ever, perhaps. Argue if you must. You know, they kind of get overlooked a little bit by all the big Beatles and Stones and Zeppelin dudes out there. The Who's a little, they're a little weird, you know. But come on, man. Smash all their gear. It's just rock and roll in its purest form and on so many levels. There was a great documentary out lately. I forget the name of it, but what was it? The Kids Are All Right or something like that? You know, interviewing the guys in the band and all that. Showing that old footage. Oh, man, like that old shot. I can't remember what gig it was, but early 70s. Just super slow-mo, just Pete Townsend just sliding on his knees across the stage as the lights are coming up. I mean, just awesome. Man, I was obsessed with Pete Townsend in high school. The Who came 1989 and played at the Cotton Bowl. It was their last show ever. You know, that was about 1,000 last shows ago. But they came through, man, and I was just obsessed with his energy, man, and the fact that he cut all his fingers off playing the guitar every night. He'd swing in his arm, windmilling, just, you know, smashing his hand against the strings. He described it, he goes, but no, everyone goes, man, everybody else, Pete, windmills like you, they swing their arm around and hit the guitar. He just goes, no one windmills like me. And so what do you mean? He's like, when I windmill, I hit my entire hand against the guitar strings. Flesh flies off. Blood squirts all over the stage. No one else does it like that. And he does, man. He just had, there's a famous picture of him, you know, leaning on his hand after a show, you know, on Rolling Stone. He's got tape all over his hands, just blood running all the way down his arm. You know, drunk, deaf, just kicking ass until he has nothing left, Pete Townsend. And just jumping around the whole time. Just incredible, man. I was just obsessed with, like, man, this guy just... And you know what? There's an element that I get on stage. Everybody gets on stage. I've talked to it about some other guys, just where you're so... You can get so into your stuff, man. You can bust your lip on the mic, you know, try and sing and run too fast. And, you know, like 10 minutes later, you realize you have blood in your mouth and you're just so lost in your stuff, man. That's the best feeling there is when just, you know, literally you just don't feel pain or you're up there going. It's a great feeling. And Townsend always seemed to be able to get there every night and just destroy with a guitar in his hands. Well, man, one of their interesting little things they always did at the show, Substitute, they had these, like, little, you know, kind of poppy songs that they'd play, and then it'd be, you know, juxtaposed with these bombastic mini-operas and things that they would play. This is one I always loved here. Great Who song here, man. Substitute. Like all great bands, a lot of infighting in The Who. Man, one of the most brutal things I ever heard anyone say about anybody else in his own band was Pete Townsend being interviewed. And he said, you know, they're talking about his conflict with lead singer Roger Daltrey, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed singer, who, you know, didn't write any of the songs, he just sang them. That was it. That was the arrangement. Townsend wrote all the songs. Most of them. I mean, all of them. And then the bass guy, you know, he wrote a couple. Townsend goes, well, I can sum it up very simply. You know, I was brilliant. I wrote the first rock opera. I was brilliant. Keith Moon, our drummer, was a genius. A genius. John Entwistle on the bass was the most incredible bass player the world had ever seen. He was a genius as well. Roger, talking about Daltrey, the singer, he just kind of looks at the ceiling and goes, Roger was, he kind of shrugged his shoulders and goes, a singer. Just like, he's just some singer, like, who cares? And you know what? It was pretty poignant, man. Because you really think about Keith Moon on the drums, man. He's just a legend. The way he played was so crazy and zany. Same for Entwistle on the bass. John Entwistle. Just nuts, man. Crazy stuff. The stuff Townsend wrote was wild. It had never been done before. And Daltrey was a very good singer. Good front man. But, you know, you wouldn't put him in a category maybe as like you would maybe those other guys at their respective positions. So over the years, you always got this conflict between Pete and Roger. Pete's always, he's sitting home making royalty money. And Daltrey, who didn't write the songs, he's always kind of broke and pushing to go out on the road. Or at least that's the impression you get from listening to Pete Townsend talk about it. The Who. The Mighty Who. Well, man, I'm going to leave you with this last little vignette from Live at Leeds. What was this on? I don't even remember. But this the version of this is great. It was used in the movie Rushmore. This is the end. The ending movement is like three different movements, like a little mini opera. A quick one while he's away. This is the end part where it just rocks your face off to the end. That is how we will leave you this week, folks, on the podcast. P2 here. Thanks for listening. My thanks to Chance, Ryan, Brenton for dropping by, talking some enigmatic Clint Rippey with us about his new documentary on Clint that I'm involved in and loving every minute of. Well, next week, man, we're going to try to get our old friend Blue on here. Blue, J.W. Marshall, dropping by the studio, talking about his experiences in the full band. Until then, we wish you all well. Stay good to each other out there, folks. Much tougher.
Her man's been gone for nigh on a year. He was due home yesterday, but he ain't here. Her man's been gone for nigh on a year. He was due home yesterday, but he ain't here.
Driver to make you feel much better.
Dirty old sod.
I said steady on.
My name is Ivor. I'm an engine driver. I know him well. I know why you feel blue. Just cause he's late.
You mean no liar, I
kissed a few and once did sit on either the engine driver's lap.